Our next panelist is Dr. John G. West. He is a senior fellow at the Seattle-based Discovery Institute, where he directs the program on religion, liberty, and civic life, and is co-director of Discovery's Center for the Renewal of Science and Culture. Dr. West is the author of The Politics of Revelation and Reason, and also the author of the fifth volume of the Encyclopedia of the American Constitution, and was editor of the New Federalist Papers. Dr. West holds a PhD in political science from the Claremont Graduate School and is currently assistant professor of political science at Seattle Pacific University. Dr. West.
Boy, double barrel. One of my favorite authors is Nathaniel Hawthorne. And I think that his stories about the Puritans provide a key insight into both the peril and the promise of religion and republicanism. Of course, Hawthorne is best known, perhaps, for his stories exposing Puritan intolerance. Anyone who's read The Scarlet Letter or Young Goodman Brown knows what I'm talking about. In Hawthorne's portrait, one might even call it a caricature, the Puritans are severe, unsmiling, uncompromising. My favorite Hawthorne tale related to this point is a rather obscure short story titled The Man of Adamant. The hero, if I may call him that, of this tale is a minister whose views on salvation are so narrow that they can only save himself. So he ends up abandoning civil society and going to live in a cave, walled off from the rest of the world, where he gradually turns into concrete as his heart becomes ever harder towards his fellow citizens. What a graphic picture of how antisocial religious intolerance can be. By dividing citizens from each other on religious grounds, Hawthorne shows that religion can make republicanism all but impossible. Yet, this was not all that Hawthorne had to say on the subject. In another short story, The Gray Champion, he puts forward a rather different view of Puritanism. The Great Champion is set in Boston during the attempt by King James II to subjugate the American colonies in 1689. The title character of this story turns out to be a mysterious first-generation Puritan who shows up like a fiery Old Testament prophet and denounces the usurpations of royal governor Sir Edmund Andros and urges the people to resistance. In this story, Hawthorne showed how the same religious idealism that spawned the Puritans' intolerance also produced a rock-solid commitment to moral principle that made them resist political tyranny. At the end of this story, Hawthorne directly connected this Puritan spirit to the spirit of resistance that animated the American Revolution. Hence the paradox of religion and republicanism. Religion's intolerance may destroy republican government, but its rigorous attachment to moral principle may be necessary to save it. This is a profound insight. The very same intolerance, again, that makes religion destructive to republicanism also makes it a great help to free government. The genius of the American founding, I would argue, was the manner in which it resolved this paradox by harnessing the moral idealism of religion while restraining its potential for bigotry. America's founders harnessed religion's moral idealism by stressing the importance of morality in civic life and by acknowledging the critical role churches played in fostering and defending that morality. Sometimes it's argued that the founders believed that the republic that they set up was a machine that would run itself without the need for virtue among the citizens. I think that's simply wrong. Most founders would have fully embraced Benjamin Franklin's statement that only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. Not only did the founders believe that virtue was important, they also believed that religion was key to inculcating that virtue. Think of George Washington's comments in his farewell address that Dr. Elley already cited. Of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And Washington goes on to caution people against believing that education alone without religion is sufficient to secure a national morality. Or consider John Adams' observation, also cited by Dr. Eliot, that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. Indeed, some founders thought that the churches in America fulfilled the role of the censor morum in Rome, the public official in Rome who had the power of regulating the manners and morals of the people. The Reverend John Witherspoon made this point in his lectures on moral philosophy at Princeton. In ancient times, he said, in great states, the censorial power was found necessary to their continuance, which inspected the manners of men. It seems probable that supporting the religious sects in modern times answers this end, for the particular disciplines of each sect is intended for the correction of manners. James Madison echoed Witherspoon's view to a correspondent in 1823, reporting that in Virginia, the settled opinion is that rival sects with equal rights exercise mutual censorships in favor of good morals. Some founders even explicitly argued that ministers have a responsibility to speak up about the pressing moral problems facing society. In the words of John Adams, it's the duty of the clergy to accommodate their discourses to the times, to preach against such sins as are most prevalent, and recommend such virtues as are most wanted. At the same time the founders upheld religion's role as a defender of morality, however, they also sought to temper religion's intolerance by removing theological questions from the political arena, which greatly reduced the consequences of religious intolerance by ensuring that state power would never be used to resolve theological controversies. By limiting the purposes of government to this life rather than life eternal, the founders sought to make religion and republicanism compatible. What made this proposal work was an additional proviso that government policies in earthly matters would be based on a common moral standard shared by both reason and revelation. The founders' arrangement produced an institutional separation between church and state, even while forging a practical tie between religion and politics on the basis of morality. Religious believers were discouraged by the nature of the regime from trying to use the government to promote their theological beliefs, but the door was left open for them to enter the political and social arena as equal citizens in order to promote policies in accord with both the principles of the Constitution and the laws of nature and nature's God on which those principles are premised. The political and social activities of religious believers in the new nation largely reflected the founders' understanding of the role of religion in society. First, most religious believers fully accepted the idea of religious liberty and that they shouldn't try to impose their religion by government. Indeed, devout religious believers were some of the strongest supporters of religious liberty in America. Many evangelical Protestants even opposed state funding of churches because they thought it corrupted religion. And gradually, even the Congregationalists who supported establishments of religion in New England changed their minds. Second, when religious believers did become involved in politics and society in the early nation, they generally sought to do so on the basis of the principles of civic morality that were held in common by reason and revelation. In the years before the Civil War, for example, they entered the political and social arena by the thousands to spearhead crusades against dueling, war, poverty, prostitution, alcoholism, and of course slavery. These activities on behalf of secular concerns proved that religious believers could play a vital, positive role in American republicanism by serving as the political conscience, the moral voice of the nation. I would argue that religion in the American Republic still fulfills the dynamic role envisioned by the founders. During the last century, religion has been at the heart of a wide range of social movements involving such issues as civil rights at home and human rights around the world. The pro-life movement is another example. In recent years, there have also been increasing cooperation on social issues between traditional Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, as they have realized that theological differences need not prevent them from making common cause on moral issues. Yet the role of religion in the American Republic remains, or is actually today, deeply problematic, because much of our society has rejected the founders' idea that there is a non-changing moral standard knowable both by reason and revelation. So the temptation is growing for religious adherents to treat moral controversies as simply religious controversies, once again dividing citizens along religious lines. I think we can see that in particular in some of the modern debates on homosexuality, which the founders would have thought both reason and revelation shows is morally problematic. But we've lost some of our common moral vocabulary, and so some of these traditional moral issues now seem as if they're just religious issues. And the temptation with the current moral breakdown is to argue them as just religious issues. But when that happens, we're once again dividing citizens along religious lines. And once that happens, we'll be back where we started from. Getting out of this current situation that we're in will no doubt be difficult. We need to rebuild the idea of an objective moral law shared by reason as well as revelation. And in order to do that, we need to debunk some of the claims of modern philosophy, and dare I say it, parts of modern science, that deny the very existence of transcultural and transhistorical moral truths. Modern Darwinists, for instance, like E.O. Wilson, claim that ethics is merely an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate. Those interested in safeguarding the role of religion in American republicanism today, I think, must first work to restore the role of natural law in American politics.